I don't remember who said this, but, you know, studying humor is like dissecting a frog, and it's no fun for the frog, and it dies in the end.
There is actually a lot of truth to that if you look at...
I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Join us every Tuesday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, or GMT-4, for a live interactive discussion at blab.im/Lisa DeLay. At that point, we will interact, ask questions, and dig deeper into the podcast episode released that day. Today, I'm joined by neuroscientist Dr. Vinod Goel from York University in Toronto, Canada. York University is the third largest Canadian university, and Dr. Goel's work has to do with the science of understanding humor and cognitive function as it relates to mindsets. He joined me from Zurich on his sabbatical, and I am really happy to have him here today.
I have been doing a podcast since April, and I've been trying to connect with different people whose work interests me. And neuroscience is really a fascinating field, and there's a lot of different places I'd love to explore. But when I ran into your work about humor, I thought that it would be interesting to talk a little bit more about your work and what you're doing now, but also just what got you involved in this particular area of neuroscience.
Okay. I mean, humor research is not my main focus. We actually got into it accidentally. We sort of stumbled into it. What we were sort of interested in exploring was this sort of very common phenomenon of shifting mental sets. And there are various sort of paradigms that psychologists and neuropsychologists have used to study this phenomenon. But it occurred to me that this is exactly what jokes are. Is, you know, you receive a sort of a setup line, which leads you to have certain expectations. It leads you to have expect an answer in a certain area. So, for example, you know, what do engineers use for birth control? Well, you might say the pill. You know, kind of like, so there's a certain search space. But then when you see the punchline, it takes you into a total different search space. And so there's the shift, but so the punchline in this case might be their personalities. Mm-hmm. So that takes you into a total different search space. And what you have to do is you have to integrate those two semantic spaces. So it was a tool for us to look at this phenomenon. Once we got into it, it became interesting in of itself. Because humor, I mean, in addition to allowing us to explore that phenomenon, this mental set shift, it also has an affective component. So it's not that you simply do that set shift, but if you're successful in doing it, and given certain parameters, sort of typically social norm parameters, you may find it funny. And if you do find it funny, there is an affective sort of reward component associated with it. And, so, and in fact, it's so gratifying that we pay to be, you know, to listen to jokes. We go to comedy shows. We watch comedy channels on TV. So, you know, we are willing to pay for it. Now, not all situations might, you know, lead to be funny. So if that same joke, if you'd heard it yesterday, then you would still do the set shift, but you wouldn't find it humorous. Or if you were offended by it, then you would sort of stretch the social boundaries and dampen the humor effect.
And so I know that brain scanning is part of your testing process in your studies, and so maybe you can talk a little bit about what sorts of brain scans you did and what they reveal. But part of what you said about if you're offended by a joke, it's not funny to you. And I'm assuming that different areas are lighting up in the brain or not lighting up yes. as they would in a person who, you know, is sold on the joke, thinks it's really amusing.
Right, right. So the basic techniques we've used are fMRI studies. And these are pretty standard for most cognitive tasks. And we've also done some patient work with this material. What the imaging studies involve is putting people in an fMRI, in an MRI scanner. They lie there, and then either the material is presented to them visually, in the case of cartoons, or in the case of verbal material, we did it auditorily. And so they listen to it. They find it funny, or you know, and then they respond. We can ask them, "How funny do you find it? Do you find it funny? Yes, no. Are you offended?" Various questions can be asked, and we can register a response. And then, when all is said and done, what we do is we time lock the scanning session with the responses, the presentation of the stimuli and the responses, and then we can go back and look at sort of the neural correlates of you know, seeing this material, saying it's funny or not funny or offensive, and we can sort of break it down in different ways.
Well, it's interesting. So the type of humor you're really pinpointing is sort of semantics and language, but also has that social component. But and you haven't probably studied this part yet, but do you think that would translate into something like physical humor where there's like a pratfall or a pie in the face or something like that? Do you would there be a corollary there because it's not using language, do you think?
Yes. Now, that's actually an interesting question. And it's part of a bigger question. When we did the studies, I just assumed that humor was unique to humans. Okay? And I wrote that in the manuscript. But then I had someone call me up. They were sort of offended by that. They said, "Well, look." And this person was actually a neuroscientist. He did work. He studied rats. And he said, "Look, when I take my rats, I turn them on their back and rub their tummies, their bellies, you know, they find it pleasurable. And why isn't that sort of humor appreciation?" So that got me thinking a little bit in terms of the triggers. So the triggers I've talked to you about have been semantic. But maybe there is a scale here in terms of the triggers, from physical triggers like tickling someone, to you know, dropping a plate, or and then you can sort of look at children's humor. Children's humor is typically not semantic. So if you have kids 5 or 6 years old, when they go to school and come back and tell you jokes, they're puns. They're not semantic jokes. So they rely upon the differential meaning of a specific word, but the literal meaning of a differential literal meanings of specific words. When they're older, around 13, 14 years old, and then into adulthood, then the triggers turn more to semantic jokes. And in the adults, those jokes can become very abstract. For a pun, it may, what is orange and sounds like a parrot, a carrot. So this is what a joke that your child would tell you. Mm-hmm. And it hinges upon the term "sounds like," as in speaking, speaks like, or sounds as in the rhyme. Okay, so, and for most adults, if your child tells you that joke, you'd laugh, but it's not. Another little bit more sophisticated one might be something like an elephant asked a mouse why he was so small. The mouse replied, "I've been sick." So this is not quite a pun. It's
right.
Moving into the semantic direction. A little bit more sophisticated. I asked my American friend, "Why are you so sure Iraq has weapons of mass destruction?" He replied, "We kept the receipts."
Each
of these, what's happening is you have to have a larger, sort of more sophisticated background semantic network fit them in and to appreciate them. and even in a more sophisticated, overheard in 18th century England. Did you hear that George Berkeley died? His girlfriend stopped seeing him. So there you actually have to know something about the philosophy of George Berkeley. And if you don't, then you wouldn't actually find that funny. So there is this progression. I think there is sort of a so in terms of the trigger, I think there is a difference between a physical trigger and a symbolic trigger. And within the symbolic triggers, you go from puns to sort of semantic and very sophisticated semantic material. That's sort of the way I view it.
Mm-hmm. And you're in Zurich right now. Does it have to do with this kind of study that you've been doing, or have you transitioned to something else in Zurich?
No, I'm just on sabbatical in Zurich.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, for the last few years, what our work has focused on is the role of emotions in reasoning and decision making. So, but that's sort of a slightly different area.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been, in fact, the impetus for this came from watching American politics over the past.
Well, I can understand that. There's a lot of logic goes right out the window.
Yes.
That actually, I find to segue to something like that, because that is also really intriguing to me, studying a little bit of critical thinking and some of the logical fallacies, which sadly don't tend to be taught very often. And so you have a lot of really irrational arguments and things like that. I find that people are pretty irrational in general. And what you're speaking of in terms of emotion affecting decision making, does that refer to different kinds of stressors, or maybe you can just unpack that a little bit?
Yeah. No, so for example, the, again, sort of watching the last few years of American politics, I remember during the last, the last congressional elections, I think.
Mm-hmm.
There was the, remember the someone wanted to build a mosque near Ground Zero.
Mm-hmm, right.
Okay. And so the, at that time, there were advertisements that were being aired on American television and online. I'm just going to see if I can quickly find one just to make sure I get it right.
Mm-hmm.
Hang on here. And there was one in which, you know, they showed the 9/11 crash. They showed, you know, horrendous scenes. They showed up Arab men marching with guns and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And there was sort of a voiceover on that. So essentially, the argument that they made in that movie, in that piece, was all 9/11 perpetrators were Muslims. All 9/11 perpetrators were terrorists, therefore all Muslims are terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
And that had enormous consequences.
Mm-hmm.
The in terms of the elections, in terms of movement of money, I think the Republicans won the House from the Democrats. But the argument is, of course, flawed. Now, if you take the same argument and you take the emotional content out, the structure of the argument is something like, well, it's exactly like, all roses have flowers, all roses have thorns, therefore all flowers have thorns. Now there, no one would, or fewer people would make that mistake.
Mm-hmm.
So what we've been looking at is how the, how emotions sort of sidetrack us, derail us in terms of the reasoning process.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we've been doing this with MRI and then with some patient studies.
Mm-hmm. And you find that on the brain scan that the emotion will wind up not engaging those reasoning centers of the brain in the frontal lobe. Is that what you tend to see then on the scans?
Well, what we find is in the emotional cases where the argument is laden with emotion, the sort of the typical area of the brain that would deal with the logical structure of argument is the left dorsolateral prefrontal cortex.
Mm-hmm.
In these cases, we get activation in the medial ventral prefrontal cortex instead of the dorsolateral, and we can sort of modulate between the two. So it's mm-hmm. taking a different route.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the question is, what's happening with this medial ventral? So we did some patient studies to look at this.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, these patient studies are interesting in this context because they were with war veterans.
Right. Mm-hmm.
They were with, in fact, the Vietnam War veterans. And we had some emotional material mm-hmm. relating to wars and politics and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And what we found is in the patients that had lesions to the medial ventral prefrontal cortex, they could reason about the neutral logical material perfectly fine.
Hmm.
But in terms of the emotionally laden material, they couldn't, they performed very poorly.
Hmm.
So the story that we're telling has to do something with the medial ventral, I think, is involved in filtering out the emotional content, and to the extent it's successful in filtering out the emotional content, then it passes on that material to the dorsolateral, and it can sort of perform the logical operations.
Mm.
If it's not successful, then the emotional content gets passed on, and things don't go very well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the case of our patients, they actually had lesions in area of the ventral medial prefrontal cortex.
In
the case of the general population, when these arguments sort of seem to be widely accepted, it probably has to do with individual differences in the ability to engage medial ventral and dorsolateral prefrontal cortex.
Hmm. So taking this into sort of everyday life, when we are in a highly aroused emotional state, we are going to be less able to make logical decisions. And is there a way that we're able to compensate for some of these deficiencies?
Yes. Now, there are certain sort of interesting factors that modulate it. So I said there are individual differences.
Mm-hmm.
So individuals that have more education, individuals that have higher IQ, they're much better at compensating for the differences.
Mm.
So they're much better at detecting that, you know, that there's something wrong here. They become more vigilant. And in some cases, with some subset of individuals, they actually do better in the emotionally laden tasks.
Hmm.
So we don't fully understand why, so we can't take a certain set of individuals and make them do better or make them do worse. So we don't fully understand what's going on there. But there is considerable evidence to indicate that years of education, IQ, working memory capacity play an important role.
Hmm. Yeah, that is really fascinating. But I suppose that in those cases where you're spending a lot of time learning and growing, and your brain is creating new pathways, you're using your brain in a very different way than someone who hasn't had all those experiences and doesn't have all those parts of their brain engaged.
Yeah.
And so with the veterans who actually had brain damage, essentially, did you know that going in that they actually had lesions and that caused, you did know that?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
So these were, as I say, Vietnam veterans, and so they've been studied for about 30 years now.
Mm.
So this is why they're such a valuable source for us. We know almost everything about them.
Mm.
And unlike the more recent veterans, the Iraqi veterans and the Afghanistan veterans,
mm-hmm.
they the Vietnam veterans actually had penetrating head injuries. So, which again, and again, sort of not so good for them, but mm-hmm. for us as scientists trying to understand the working of the brain, mm-hmm. it's very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And then is there a way for, I mean, maybe your study didn't cover this quite yet, but is there a way for them to compensate for the damage done to their brain by retraining in some way? I mean, I know that there's some plasticity to the brain, and I've read a little bit about some of the advances in neuroplasticity, even for stroke patients, people who've suffered strokes, and getting some of the use of their limbs back and stuff, and really essentially rewiring how their brain will control certain parts of their body. And I guess I just wonder, in the cases of them, the people who have the actual brain damage, is it just seem like a lifelong predicament, or is there sort of things available to them for therapy?
Well, it actually depends upon where the damage is.
Mm.
So in certain areas, there is very limited scope for recovery. I mean, in all cases, there is some recovery that occurs within the first, 3-4 months after the damage. And in some sort of motor cases, we can sort of extend this by physical therapies regimes. In other cases, as odd as it may seem to say, it really doesn't have a big impact on their lives. That is, many of these veterans that we study, because my focus is on the prefrontal cortex. And so many of these individuals, they have extremely high IQs. Their working memories are intact. Their long-term memories are intact. And so you could interact with them and never know they have, they suffered brain injury. They're quite functional. There are certain things they can't do. And so with certain tests, you can sort of predict these. But meeting them casually, you would, for many of them, you would not guess. For some of them, you would. But for many of them, you would not guess. And so the in terms of recovery, in terms of the consequences of these injuries for their daily life, it really depends upon the location, the extent, the etiology, and sort of the timing, whether you were 2 years old or whether you were 20 years old or 60 years old. When you're 2 years old, the scope for reorganization and recovery is much greater, obviously, than when you're 20 or 40 years old. But even there, it really depends upon upon location. Yeah, I mean, we once scanned a young woman for one of our studies, and it turned out that one of her hemispheres was totally atrophied.
Oh, wow.
She didn't know. We didn't know, and she was living more or less a normal life. And usually, you know, when people do these scans, we give them a picture of their brain. In this case, we had to lie to her and say, you know, the scanner, there, no image was generated or something, you know, because it would sort of be an undue hardship for her to know at this stage in midlife, because there's nothing anyone can do about it, and she's been living perfectly fine. But I did speak with her afterward to get a little bit of a medical history, and it turns out that when she was born, people thought she was stillborn, and so she was initially discarded.
Oh, my.
And then people, the mother and the parents realized, So... But the reason I bring this up is, so in this particular case, all of the functions that would be served by that hemisphere mm-hmm. were sort of completely taken over by the other hemisphere.
Wow.
Now, if she had acquired an injury to that one hemisphere, mm-hmm. sort later in life, even as a teenager or as a adolescent, mm-hmm. the recovery would not be nearly as extensive.
Mm-hmm. And so it seems like, from what I've read, which is limited, but that the brain, in a sense, has the capability of reorganizing, and there's sort of redundancies in the brain that can take over for the parts, because this woman didn't have any other problems that would indicate any kind of abnormalities, and it just was sort of by accident that you found.
Right. Wow. Exactly, because we, before we scan people, we speak to them, mm-hmm. we take a little bit of a medical, but so there was no reason to believe that she was not normal in every way. Yeah.
I know that there are probably other surprises that come along. I'm interested to know, especially from sort of for the audience's point of view, what have you found to be the most surprising? I know when you go into studies, you have some idea where things might go, but has anything turned up that has surprised you in your recent work?
Surprised us in what sense? In the theoretical sense?
In the sense of understanding the brain in a new way that is contrary to sort of common belief about the brain or about how the functions in the brain work.
Okay. I guess there have been a couple of things. So we began our work about, 15, 20 years ago. I've been working in this area.
Mm-hmm.
And prior to that, if you would ask neuropsychologists, what do the frontal lobes do?
Mm-hmm.
And, they would say, well, they reason, they do planning, they do problem solving. We had this sort of preconception within the field. And, if you ask them, if you ask participants to reason, what areas will be activated? They would say, well, the frontal lobes. And it turns out that this is not really correct. It's just an assumption in the field. No one had actually done the studies.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, the frontal lobes are critical, but they have specific contributions to make. And much of the reasoning actually occurs online in the parietal and the occipital cortex, I think. So this sort of has been a bit of a interesting finding for us.
And for people who aren't sure about the different parts of the brain and what their functions are, could you a little bit unpack what you mean by the occipital portions of the brain?
Yes, so the occipital lobes are sort of right at the back of the brain, just above the cerebellum. The cerebellum sort of tucks underneath it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the visual cortex, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So, and part of it is hardwired, some of the visual areas. And then the information from there feeds forward into the sort of upwards into the parietal and along the sides into the temporal lobes. And then into the prefrontal cortex. So we had this view of the brain as doing this very sort of basic sort of sensory-based perceptual processing at the back, and the thinking parts were at the front of the brain. And I think what we've been learning over the past 20 years is that picture is not quite correct. The thinking happens sort of online in many cases. So, for example, we began by talking about humor. So, in humor, I was talking about semantic jokes and the phonological. Now, in terms of the question of the mental set shifts, the one of the interesting things that we found is that where that set shift occurs in the brain, the parts that are sort of activated with the set shift, is a function of whether it's semantic processing or phonological processing or visual processing. Okay. And I mean, I can tell you the areas, but it may not be all that meaningful. But the important point is that there are different areas depending upon the differences. But the area, in terms of, you know, when you find something funny, it's the same area. It's a common area, irrespective of whether there's a semantic joke, a cartoon joke, or a phonological joke. Right?
Mm.
So there are things like that. Yeah.
Yeah, that is really fascinating. I wouldn't have expected that. I guess what do you suppose is, I mean, there's a lot of ideas I've heard out there about, you know, why humor is so fundamental to the human experience. It's such an essential part of everyday life for people, and you know, obviously it helps build social bonds and things like that. But how do you, in your mind, account for such a important role that it plays in, you know, in human history or in our daily interactions
with each? Yeah, no, that's an excellent question. And as you point out, there are a number of different answers people have given to it. I think the issue that I sort of focus on, or that I sort of find most compelling, is that what humor allows us to do is to entertain certain ideas that might be physically impossible or socially forbidden, and do so in a safe environment.
Mm.
So like there's this explicit understanding that we can say certain things in this space without offending people.
Mm.
Now there are boundaries to the space.
Mm-hmm.
And if we go beyond those boundaries, people are offended, and the whole thing breaks down.
Mm.
So I think so the way I look at it, it provides a safe forum, mm-hmm. a certain sort of safe boundaries in which we can sort of socially interact.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And in terms of boundaries, what's interesting is with the children's humor, you typically violate physical laws, physical
mm-hmm.
boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
With adults, it's social boundaries.
Mm.
So with, you know, as a child, I remember watching the Roadrunner and the coyote,
mm-hmm.
right? And so the poor coyote falls down the cliff, and then a piano falls on him and a rock and so forth. And he gets up, he has this big bump on his head, he pushes it down and goes back chasing the Roadrunner.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to sit there and watch that and entertain it, you have to sort of suppress what you know about how the world works
right.
in terms of physical laws. In terms of adult humor, it's social norms. It, you know, could be political, could be mm-hmm. sexual. Mm-hmm. I mean, many of the jokes, adult jokes, mm-hmm. have to do with pushing sexual norms.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're doing it in this context, there is a sort of it's a safe space.
Mm-hmm.
Where we're all sort of partaking and expecting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there is a playfulness about it that removes the threat.
Yes.
And that's interesting because the person who's taking offense is obviously feeling threatened in
yes.
some way.
Yeah.
Mm. And
yeah.
and it's interesting, and it seems uniquely human until I read about the rat studies and the tickling rats, which was funny to me in itself, but that the rats are assuming that the predicament that they're in is not a life threatening situation, and they are amused by it or somehow, you know, find it pleasurable in some way, that they are not, you know, really disturbed and stressed out.
Right. But with the rat, though, there is a sort of a basic question.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense that we find many things pleasurable,
mm.
but and humor is pleasurable,
mm-hmm.
but the quality, you know, the aspect is different. So
mm-hmm.
chocolate, I like chocolate,
mm-hmm.
And I find pleasure in eating chocolate,
mm-hmm.
and I like to watch stand-up comedy routines. Mm-hmm. But the sort of the pleasurable experience is different. So whether the rats are really, you know, finding it funny or humorous, I personally, I don't believe it. But, you know, that's just a belief. I don't have any evidence for it one way or the other.
Right. And it is a little difficult to judge, you know, as I was reading the article about the rats and thinking, maybe it's just nervous laughter, you know.
Yeah. That's right, because it could just be, I mean, there's also a difference, I think, between laughter and humor. So mm-hmm. humor is mm-hmm. one way of triggering laughter, mm-hmm. but it's not the only way. Mm. So there are certain neurological disorders where people will laugh uncontrollably.
Mm, right.
They don't feel any mirth. They don't feel, it's mm-hmm. not a pleasurable experience, mm-hmm. but they can't stop laughing.
Mm.
I remember, again, when we first did the studies, I got a call from an individual, a woman, who told me about laughing yoga.
Oh, right.
I'd never heard of laughing yoga.
Yes.
So this is a situation where a group of people sit around in a room and one begins to laugh. Now, there's no reason or basis for the laugh. There's no humor trigger. Mm-hmm. It's just a physically triggered, you know, sort of mm-hmm. volitionally triggered laugh.
Mm-hmm.
And then other people sort of laugh. And my right. question there is, so at the beginning, there is no sort of experience of mirth or the pleasurable mm-hmm. feeling.
Right.
But in the end, is there, or is it just a physical exercise? And mm-hmm. I didn't get a sort of a clear-cut understanding of that issue or response to it.
Well, that's interesting. It's not just in Eastern spirituality as well, because I've heard of this phenomenon in so-called holy laughter in Pentecostal streams of Christianity, and it is a little bit, it almost reminds me of like when people, one person yawns and then everybody starts yawning, and it almost seems like a more basal trigger than anything to do with humor or something like that, and it's almost like a contagious,
yeah.
seemingly contagious emotional affect. And it is really strange. I know it's spiritualized sometimes as mm-hmm. Some kind of, you know, mystical experience or a touch with the divine and things like that. But
right.
It does seem to be, you know, it would be interesting to just see what parts of the brain are lighting up when that's going on, because I'm assuming it wouldn't be the humor sections,
yeah.
but then who knows?
I can tell you a little bit about it. Mm-hmm. Now, as far as I know, no one has actually done a study with the yoga laughter mm-hmm. because of there are technical problems with doing it in a scan.
Right.
However, a couple of colleagues of mine did something sort of relevant. They put people in a scanner and under two conditions. One is they told them jokes or something, you know, funny, and so to solicit spontaneous laughter.
Mm-hmm.
In the second, they asked people just to laugh.
Mm.
So it's not. So this is a conscious, you know, self-induced laughter,
mm-hmm.
and they found two different brain areas were engaged in those in that case.
Mm-hmm.
So, which again suggests that. They're two different phenomena. Now,
mm-hmm.
it could be that maybe with these sort of mystical experience types of things with laughter, maybe after 5-10 minutes you do feel some mirth, or it, you know, it becomes. I don't
right.
know.
Yeah, and I just saw, you know, you can see these random things on social media now, and there was something about a woman in a subway who began laughing, and she started laughing uncontrollably. It seemed feigned at first, but then it actually seemed everybody around her was laughing, and she was laughing, it seemed, genuinely.
Mm-hmm.
And it was funny because it was going on for so long, and it was absurd, and it was like part of the unexpectedness of, you know, a subway train car of laughing people.
Right.
It got more and more absurd, and in a sense, more and more humorous. But it is it was really odd. Like, you're kind of wondering, you know, just as an onlooker, what in the world is going on here? But obviously it was an experience that was all shared, and it seemed like it was a pleasurable one.
Yeah. No, it is a genuine phenomenon, like mm-hmm. yawning. You know, mm-hmm. if you're sitting beside someone, they yawn. Mm-hmm. You know, chance it increases your likelihood of yawning, mm-hmm. and similarly with the laughter. Mm-hmm. But there are questions with, you know, that I think spontaneous laughter versus mm-hmm. Sort of consciously self-induced laughter. Mm-hmm. I think I'm sure there are two different pathways in the brain.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting how it seems to be. I feel like I'm very easily able to detect which seems phony and which seems genuine. And I don't think it's just because of who I am. I think it actually we seem to be geared to notice if laughter seems genuine or feigned.
But now, actually, that reminds me of another thing. Mm-hmm. And every comedy show that you watch, mm-hmm. they have a laugh track.
Right, right.
And it's hard to come across a comedy show without a laugh track.
Hmm.
Almost, I can't think of one. So the so clearly, there's two things. There is the humor that's being enacted, the joke that's being told. Mm-hmm. But to make sure that you get it and you mm-hmm. do laugh, mm-hmm. they also have the laugh track.
Yeah, the coaching yeah. aspect. Well, it's funny that you mentioned that, because one of my favorite comedy shows that's on now is Modern Family, mm-hmm. and it's done in almost a documentary sort of setup when there is no laugh track. And I had watched it long enough. And I think it's a really funny show. And then I had watched an old episode of Seinfeld back in the, you know, sitcom mm-hmm. days, the heyday of yep. sitcom perhaps. And the laugh track annoyed me to no end. I couldn't stand it. And it was like the worst part of the show. And I remember thinking, I know when something's funny, you know, and it was interesting.
It's insulting your intelligence.
Yeah, and I think that some shows have phased it out. The Office was one of the first shows that I can recall where they shot it in a different way than a sitcom, and so you're knowing that it's funny because of how awkwardly people are acting and how inappropriate their language is and things like that, but you don't need to be coached into, here's the punchline. And
right.
it is a really fascinating thing that a show will seem funnier, unless you're really aware of it, a show will seem funnier if other people are laughing. And if you're aware that there's a laugh track and you find that annoying, then you are distracted enough from the show, you might not think it's as funny.
Right. But as I said, they're so common, I think we just background them. We mm-hmm. sort of expect them. And I'm thinking of Raymond I watched for years.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And before, you know, the Family Ties years ago and Home Improvement, all of these mm-hmm. sort of basic core shows
mm-hmm.
Use laugh tracks.
Yes.
And,
yeah, that's really interesting. And I'm sure that that started when, you know, first live audiences, and then when they were just filming in a studio, they didn't have anyone to laugh, and so they just inserted it in there.
Exactly. But, now, yeah. Actually, just another thought that occurs to me as we're talking about these shows,
mm-hmm.
with respect to the violation of social norms when you go too
mm-hmm.
far.
Mm-hmm.
Now, think of Archie Bunker.
Right.
I don't know if you're old enough to remember Archie
yeah.
Bunker, but... Mm-hmm. So I used to watch that in the 70s, early mm-hmm. 70s, I believe.
Okay.
Now, today, if we were to show that show, most people may not think it was that funny because the social norms have shifted.
Yeah,
and
that's true.
Much of the language and sort of the background assumptions of that show would no longer be appropriate.
Mm, right. Right. And you know, some of the assumptions that are being challenged you know, in sort of an avant-garde way, there are, you know, things like racial equality mm-hmm. was up for grabs at that point,
yeah.
perhaps, and now it's kind of like this is just stupid. It's not humorous, you know.
Right.
I know what you mean, and I've seen plenty of reruns of the show, and I didn't get it either. I just kind of thought, what's the matter
yeah.
with this?
The
Why do they keep showing this old man saying stupid things?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, go ahead.
I was saying, there's the racial component. There's also the treatment of women component.
Mm-hmm. Right.
in that show, and neither of those would be sort of acceptable because now we've sort of shifted the boundaries mm-hmm. and firmed them up. In the end of the 60s, early 70s, they were both sort of being negotiated, mm-hmm. and so the show, it was probably placed appropriately mm-hmm. for that time frame. Mm-hmm. But 30 years later, 40 years later, it isn't.
And that brings up an interesting point, and maybe I won't take up too much more of your day here, but in terms of social norms changing and things like that, that seems to be, generationally based, if you will. And then there are just things that are sort of always funny, if that makes sense, or maybe you even disagree with that, but in the case where something is sort of just classically funny and is not dependent on pushing boundaries in some social way, what do you think is sort of the common denominator that allows us to find humor in something?
Universally funny. Can you give me some examples of what types of thing you're thinking of?
Yeah, and maybe there isn't something that's universally funny. I guess I'm trying to think. Or maybe when someone makes a mistake and mm-hmm. it's not based on any kind of social beliefs or social perceptions, but that someone just messes up.
So, for example, a waiter drops a plate.
Right, or just, someone speaks out of turn, or someone just bumbles and makes a gaffe or something like that, and I guess it's a little tricky to say, because the things I'm thinking of in my mind, I'm immediately dismissing because I'm like, oh, maybe not everybody would think that was funny. Mm-hmm. But if there was something that that was sort of this grounding, most people most of the time will think a certain kind of humor is funny, what parts of their brain would be engaged, and why would most people think something was funny that wasn't dependent on social norms?
Okay. So my sense is that any candidate for sort of universal funniness or funniness across, social periods mm-hmm. or across cultures would need to be a less and less semantically based. Mm. And more towards physical triggers and puns or, mm-hmm. pie in the face type of thing. Mm-hmm. As you get into more sophisticated humor, it relies more and more upon our educational backgrounds, assumptions, and so forth. Mm-hmm. So that's, I think, one point. Mm-hmm. But the second point, in terms of the brain, I think sort of the same areas mm-hmm. Would be activated if we genuinely thought it funny. Mm-hmm. So whether, in these studies we're seeing whether it's a sexual joke, whether it is a pun that a child might tell you, whether it is a semantic joke, mm-hmm. the routes by which these are processed differ in the brain. Mm-hmm. But the when we do find it funny, it seems to be sort of the same few core areas mm-hmm. are activated, so mm-hmm. that there's a commonality mm-hmm. across the funniness mm-hmm. Component.
So do you consider yourself a funny person?
My kids certainly wouldn't think so. I have a teenage daughter who assures me that I'm the most boring person in the world.
Well, familiarity might set her off, but it is amusing to me to think who studies things like this just from a neuroscience brain point of view, or maybe it is amusing to you what is funny and what isn't, and if you actually find humor in the topic you're studying, or is it the kind of thing where I remember who said this, but studying humor is like dissecting a frog, and it's no fun for the frog, and it dies in the end.
There is actually a lot of truth to that if you look at that's why to actually see the fun in it, you have to sort of step back. So for example, if I, you know, was to reiterate to you the details of the experiment, the control condition, the specific brain areas that are activated, you would lose the big picture. It wouldn't be very entertaining or funny.
Right.
But if you give it sufficient distance and you look at sort of the main sort of questions, the conceptual issues, and the types of answers that are emerging, then I think it is a lot of fun.
Yeah, and then too. Obviously, there must be some kind of like dopamine release for you to feel happier, right? I mean, I don't know if you study that aspect of it too, but you know, when people are, you know, they just want to feel cheered up, and they might go to a comedy show. I mean, there is an actual brain, there is brain chemistry changing
The
brain.
Absolutely, and I mean the other. I don't know if I've already mentioned this or not. So this common area that we find with humor, this common activation, it's also activated when you give the brain drugs, when you give it chocolate. So it overlaps with the general reward center of the brain. So there is that component. So there is a biochemistry, a pharmacological story that one can tell here. That's not my sort of area of expertise, but clearly that's what's going on at that level.
And that makes sense, sort of in an anthropological sense too. Is that, you know, if hunter gatherers are gathered around a fire and they're telling funny stories, you know, they're having better mental health, they're having better brain health. Which would help them survive, and it kind of makes a really practical, a practical aspect to humor. Humor isn't just for fools or something. It's actually going to help the health of your brain.
Yes, and also it's a very, I think, sophisticated marker of intelligence, because you have to view the world in a way that it's not to get the joke. Whether it's for children, you know, with the coyote and the you know, the physical laws, or whether with adults. So the, you know, the first marker of intelligence is to be able to represent the world. But to be able to lie or to be able to tell jokes, it requires even more sophisticated abilities, meta abilities, because then you have to be able to represent the world the way it is and in a way that it's not and know it's not like that. So it's also a marker, I think, of intelligence in that sense. This is why I'm skeptical about the rats.
You're not quite sold. Yeah, until you see one of, you know, like a rat comedy club, and you can know for sure. Well, it's really, I'll just say this one more point before I go. I have my son has some cognitive disabilities, and he has autism. Didn't speak till he was about 5 years old. And what was really fascinating, so he's sort of developmentally delayed maybe 5 years. Okay. Reads at about a second grade level, but he's 15. And I noticed that around 10 or 11 years old, he started getting jokes. And it was really remarkable. And he likes telling riddles now. And he likes to, he finally achieved a stage where cognitively he could handle something that wasn't real and find it amusing. Right. That was really interesting milestone for him, because it came so late, but so did other things. And his language came late and his humor came late, but it still arrived. And he does find pleasure in amusing people with puns and riddles and things.
Yeah, no, and that's normal. And with most children, you don't even notice it. But because it was delayed in this case, you sort of can sort of, explicitly track it. And hopefully he'll continue to develop.
And I think it's very much a positively reinforced, because it becomes a bridge to communicate with other people and to develop friendships. So I think it's been really good. It's just when he tells the same one over and over.
Most children do that.
Right. I'm hoping he grows out of it, but I realize that's part of him figuring it out. And it is a pleasure. I mean, you know, so I'm sort of doubly blessed, because I get to laugh at his joke. Even if it's not funny, I get to laugh that he tried and be amused by that. But I also get to be amused that that he is progressing, that his brain is developing, and seeing his brain as, you know, his story isn't finished, and his brain is still developing. So,
it'll continue to develop for some time. Yes.
Right. So, thank you so much for sharing your
You're
time
welcome.
With me, and I will I'll send you an email when this is ready to be aired, in case you want to share it. But I really appreciate your time.
Did you know that every episode of Spark My Muse has show notes? You can find show notes at sparkmymuse.com, and in those show notes you'll find details about the people, books, and resources that were mentioned in the show. And sometimes you'll find photos and embedded videos too. I hope you'll stop by and check it out. Don't forget to join us on blab.im/LisaDelay every Tuesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, or GMT-4. Or you can catch the replay of the live discussion at sparkmymuse.com.